Hello there. We're trying to keep Choral Chihuahua going, and so we draw your attention to the possibility of listening to us on Patreon for just a few quid a month. This also magically gets rid of the ads. That's Patreon with an E, patreon.com/choralchihuahua. On with the app.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hello and welcome to Choral Chihuahua.
Cool suspension.
For this edition of the podcast, we're talking about young voices today, young singers. And I'm really, really thrilled to be joined by two people who I've seen work for years and have admired for a long time. Today's guests are Anita Morrison, who teaches singing at, well, you can tell us, Anita, where do you teach?
Well, currently I teach at Cardinal Vaughan School, where Scott's director of music. I teach the Schola at London Oratory School. I teach boys at St George's at Windsor. I teach the St John's choristers in Cambridge. And I did for nearly 30 years. I used to teach the choruses at Westminster Cathedral. That's where I got most of my experience just sort of, worked out how to do it.
Nice. Well, lucky them. We'll come and talk about that, come back to that in a minute. And the second guest is Scott Price, who is, well, director of music at Cardinal Vaughan, but so much more. Scott, tell us a bit about what you do and what you've been up to.
Well, I am, yes, the director of music at the Cardinal Vaughan School, where I've worked for close to 30 years now, 1995 when I came to the school, unbelievably. And one of the things I do here is run the Schola, the boys' choir that we have. And we have a lot of fun with that, yeah. So we can maybe talk about that a little bit more. But that's essentially me. I work at the school and I seem to have always done.
Yeah, lovely. Well, it feels like a life sentence of a good kind, maybe. Let's crack on with some music first up. Scott, you've brought the first track today, which is a sort of particularly kind of personal choice for you, is it?
Well, I just thought, having heard you very kindly mentioned us in the last episode, and you talked about Malachi, who's this extraordinary boy that we have here at the moment, who's been doing so very well. And it's just been announced in the week that he's been signed to Universal, and his album is coming out. I was looking who else is on the same label, people like Stevie Wonder and Andrea Bocelli. It's quite a list, so bless him. So I thought maybe it would be lovely to hear a track from his forthcoming record. They've released one single. This is the Lloyd Webber Pia Jesu, which is what he sang when he appeared on Britain's Got Talent and in the initial audition. And got his golden buzzer from Simon Cowell. So this is Malachi singing that.
Thank you.
That was Malachi Bayo singing Pia Jesu by Andrew Lloyd Webber. Now, he's an extraordinary kid, isn't he, Scott? Well, both of you, because you teach him as well, Anita, is that right?
That's right, yes. I see him every couple of weeks for a lesson.
Scott, do you want to just tell us a little bit about his journey and how you've... I mean, how do you discover someone like that? What do you do with a boy who's obviously so extraordinarily musical and committed like that?
Yeah, it's been a real roller coaster the last 6 months, especially a real adventure and all new territory. Obviously, we've been in. It's important to acknowledge, and I'd want to say straight away that he started singing at St. George's Cathedral when he was seven, and so when he came to us in the first year when he was 11, he'd already got quite a lot of singing experience, and he already had the kind of the very lovely voice that he kind of has. It was there, the kernel of it certainly was there. And the quality of it, which is unusual, I think, it's not your standard treble singing voice. Anita can maybe talk more about that, but it was already there and already very expressive. And I think the first time I realised there was something extraordinary about it. Actually, you were there, Nick. It was when we did the John Passion in March of 22. And we'd been, you know, we were performing the piece and it was all going along fine and everyone was doing what they should do. And then he got up towards the end to sing Zephlisa and just completely floored the place. And the atmosphere was just transformed by this extraordinary performance. And it was the first real sign of how gifted he is, I think. And people still talk to me about that performance, you know, musicians who were playing in the orchestra and people who were in the audience. And... So soon after that, then he played the role of Oberta. He got the part of Oberta at the Covent Garden in Alcina and did very, very well with that. And there was an unfortunate incident which gathered a lot of publicity at the time, of course. People might remember when someone shouted out in the audience, which only helped to really, in a sense, to bring him to people's attention more. And then Classic FM got in touch, Alid Jones. Who was wonderful with all this, made the videos with him that we did at Christmas time, and those went viral. I think 25 million views of him singing O Holy Night. And then, you know, in January, he did the Britain's Got Talent thing, and that was released then in April. I think that's had 55 million views now since then, all around the world. There's something about him that just on the internet seems to absolutely capture people's, you know, hearts and imaginations, and that the response to him is just universally positive. And the great thing about him, I was thinking about this, you know, the great thing about him is that behind all the hype and the fuss, especially with the BGT show, nonetheless, behind all that, there is a really genuinely very gifted boy, a very talented boy. When you got to watch his performances at the Albert Hall, when he sang Handel and Mozart with the orchestra of E&O, to see just how genuinely gifted he is, you know, it's remarkable, actually.
Yeah, there's proper substance, isn't there, behind it. I mean, I remember that John Passion, mostly for the Zephlisa that he sang, which, and there's always something amazing, I think, about boys singing that music. You know, it was written for young voices, obviously. But not just for that, because I just remember him, because obviously that he was singing in the choir as well, which is absolutely brilliant. And he sang every single chorus, and there's a lot of it in that piece. Sang every single chorus right from his heart, and he was dramatically involved, and he was also incredibly emotionally involved in the story, which isn't, like you say, is an unusual thing for a kid of that age. I will never forget that. I think, you know, it's an extraordinary display of kind of commitment and musicality. Anita, can you talk a bit about how you've worked with Malachi? What happens with that kind of musical personality?
He has got a distinctive voice, but I always think that every single boy that I teach has their own distinctive voice, which is really important. And with Malachi, he was always just able to sing the notes. There was never any problem with him getting around the notes. But we worked very hard on him really taking ownership of it, really understanding the text. I remember vividly, quite often, and he needed reminding, but he would take an idea usually, and then he would really run with it. So, for example, that Sir Fleece mein Herzer in Fluten der Zähren, I used to think of it being that Fluten was floods. So we started, if you sing it thinking in floods of tears, you sing it one way. And I just sort of had a little look just to double check that I'd got the translation right. And it was melts, the translation I found. And so we played with it, thinking about melting and how that changed the vocal colour, it's just so lovely to be able to work in that way. And I think that was the key to the way that he sang it, was getting that melting, flowing in that way to really bring it to life, which is how I've worked with him. Well, I tend to work with most of my students, try to work from the text and feeling how the text changes the colour and your emotional engagement with the music and with your voice, and exploring all of those differences and the wonderful things that the voice is capable of, so that you develop more choice.
Yeah, we talk a fair bit on this about things like intent and intention, and obviously text and poetry. What is it? How does that work with a younger voice? Is their imagination fired up in the same way, or do you have to? Are the keys to it in a slightly different place for them?
It's to try to get it to find images, try thoughts that they can relate to. Of course, they won't understand anything that they can't, they haven't experienced themselves. They can't draw on something they haven't experienced. So, trying to find something or an occasion or even thinking about, melting chocolate, or it can be anything. It doesn't really matter what it is. It's just to try and wake that imagination up. And because I really do, in my heart of hearts, believe that anyone can find any of this and sing with that level of sort of quality if they find the right intention. If you have the right intention for your voice, that that you can really, anyone can do anything. And I think the boys, if I can get them out of their own way and get them into their singing brains and out of their intellectual brains, where they're overthinking all the time, then that's when the magic starts to happen.
Yeah, that's lovely. Let's hear another track, shall we? What have you brought for us, Anita?
Well, I've brought, I teach the boys at London Oratory as well, and they sing a lot of polyphony. And I thought this was a really nice example of them. It's Resonet in Laudibus by Lassus.
That was Resonate in Laudibus by Orlando Di Lasso, with the Schola of the London Oratory School, conducted by Charles Cole. Now, that's a really vibrant sound, Anita, from trebles as well as lower voices. What's that like to work with?
They're wonderful. So this is a sort of young, we've got younger boys at the Oratory than we have at Cardinal Vaughan, because they have a junior house. So we actually do get them in year four. And then we try to keep them singing right the way through. And on the whole, the Schola Choir then is made up of the lower voices are then the fifth and sixth forms boys. So it's a really young, energetic sound. In the recording, we did bump it up with a couple of adults, but they're really big. Charles tries to keep that to a minimum to get that young, he liked that young, vibrant sound. But hopefully you think in a refined way, and that there's a lot of shape and some and colour, and but not losing any of that that youth, not making them sound older than they are.
Yeah, I guess that's a balance we're all trying to achieve, this kind of the payoff between energy and vibrancy and commitment and refinement and finesse and precision, I suppose. And that goes for every singer of every level, I guess. Scott, can I just come to you? My sense is, we talk about lower voices in the Oratory Schola, my sense is that you're in Cardinal Vaughan, well, both of you are really good at keeping boys singing as their voices change, which I think is really, feels really important. I was a treble at Liverpool Met and just stopped when my voice changed. And I was always slightly regret that in a way, that I only took singing up a bit later then. Can you talk to us a bit, Scott, about building a choral tradition in a school in that way that allows boys to feel they can sing, I suppose, throughout their time there? Through that, it can be an embarrassing time, can't it? How should a choral tradition work? What does it give the school, I suppose? I'd like to think about that a bit. And can we also talk about the school as a place that of education, but also of artistic endeavour, and how those things, complement or conflict with each other?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, there's an awful lot there. Certainly in terms of retention, if you like, of the boys, keeping them singing as their voices change. I guess in the old days, as it were, there was the view that they should stop, and you still hear this said. And I think for every boy is different. The voice change, Anita will talk about this, I'm sure, more, but every boy is different. And some boys perhaps do need to stop for a little while because they have no range at all. But I think in my experience here, most of the boys can and do carry on singing. We run a group called the Cambiata, which is where the boys who are in that kind of in-between phase go and do their singing. All the boys carry on singing in the big choir that we have, doing what I call a bit of gentle bass, just to be still involved. Because what you don't want to do is in a school context, is have the boys associate their singing with something they did when they were little, when they were children, and that now that they're all grown up, that they don't want to do it anymore. So you don't want to lose them that way. So it's very important to try and keep it going in their kind of daily routines and in their lives. And to also to maintain the friendship groups, which is so important in schools as well. You know, the choir, all music making in the school works best when the kids are friends and come as a unit, you know. So we do try to keep it going. I'm very lucky here that I'm able to give all the boys, one of the many ways in which the school supports what we do is that it gives all the boys singing lessons. So as soon as the voice is in that sort of changing phase, as soon as there's something there to work with, we will then give them singing lessons and bring them on that way. In terms of the general culture of the school and singing, you know, I'm quite proud of what we have here at the school in terms of the singing culture. I think it's terribly important that the choir reflects the school from which it comes, you know, that any choir needs to reflect its community, I think, kind of where it's drawn from, and be relevant and important to that community. So being a faith school here, our choir has a sort of natural reason to exist, given that because it serves our liturgies. But I'm sure that can be created in a non-faith school as well. You can find a purpose and a reason for the choir to be there, and to make it central to what's going on in the school, I think is quite important. The thing about, he's talking about the question of the artistic, if you like, ambitions of the choir versus the kind of educational aspects, is something as well that I find quite interesting. Because certainly in terms of, let's say, the choir size, the choir would perhaps sound a little bit more refined if it was a bit smaller, if there wasn't 60, if it was 40. I'm talking about my choir now, obviously. But of course, the impact of it educationally is lessened, and its place in the school becomes less. So there's this balance that you don't want it to be huge, because that changes its capabilities, obviously, musically. But equally, you don't want it to become too small and too exclusive and appear to be something that is kind of overprivileged, you know, within the community. Yeah, I always think that the German boys' choirs seem to get this right. You know, they have the size, the Tamarnachor, let's say, you know, seems to balance this, the pedagogical aspect of the choir, the teaching aspect, the children needing to learn music, to balance that alongside the kind of artistic ambitions that you might have, you know. And going back to what Anita was saying about the lower voices on the recording there, and the same with my boys, you know, they don't sound like adult men singing. But that's great. That isn't a problem. That's actually a lovely thing. They don't sound quite like the back row at John's or King's, which are slightly older young men, obviously, singing. But there's something in their own terms. They're their own thing. And I think that it can be enjoyed, you know, for what it is, really. And that's the great joy, I think, of choral singing, that it's so incredibly flexible. You know, there's no right or wrong. Or no correct sound that is the only one that's acceptable, you know. It's certainly a very interesting aspect of what we do, trying to keep the voice going as the voices change. There's lots to it.
Yeah, can you just talk a little bit, loads of good stuff there, can you just talk a little bit about how you integrate what the choir does into school life? I mean, is the school really aware, you know, how are they aware what's going on with the choir? How does the choir kind of present itself within the school or within the community, I suppose?
So our choir exists, as it were, primarily, I always say, and it is true, that it exists to sing at the lower school mass that we have every Wednesday morning. So 8 o'clock on a Wednesday morning, the boys are there and we sing for the mass. So in that sense, it's very present. It's present weekly, you know, in the school. Any big occasions that the school has, and obviously things as well like our foundation day and holidays of obligation, where we would go to the local church and have the whole school together, or if we go to Westminster Cathedral, then the choir is very much present there. I sometimes wonder, the boys, even with the culture that we have here, even here, the boys are sometimes a little bit wary of singing, and, you know, in a school context with other boys and the way that they'll sort of respond to them. And I wonder, if I was in a different school where I was trying to start out something like this, I think what I might do initially is take the choir outside of school, find the performance opportunity that wasn't necessarily school-based, just to give them some confidence, you know, and to feel that they weren't necessarily going to be kind of watched by their peers quite so, and until they've developed a little bit of confidence and got some sort of sense of security in what they're doing. But then certainly here now, the boys are very happy to sing in front of their peers, and it's just part of the sort of school routine. And I think that the other kids in the school, just because children don't know any different, because that, you know, their reality is their reality, they just simply accept it as being what the way this school is. You know, we have this choir that sings at the back of the hall and sings all this church music. You know, it's kind of, imagine the way a lot of them see it, you know. And the boys in it certainly are terribly proud. I know they are. They're terribly proud of being part of it. I think largely because of the ambition of it, you know, because its aims are so kind of ambitious. I'm not saying we always get there, but certainly what we're trying to achieve is a very sort of high standard of performance. And then the opportunities as well, the things that the boys do here, you know, singing at Covent Garden and singing on film soundtracks and the like, these kind of opportunities are obviously quite something, which obviously helps to motivate the whole thing.
Yeah, absolutely. Can we just circle back a bit about to talk about voices as they change, Anita? And can you give us your perspective on what it is you're trying to give a voice through that slightly tricky time?
When I work with a boy whose voice is starting to change, I try to be absolutely upfront with them and explain exactly what's going on, because it can be a very scary time. And they're like, you know, they've been singing quite comfortably and then weird things start to happen. So I think it's really important that that's when I start to talk to them a little bit about anatomy and how the voice is produced. And I say to them, you'll probably wake up, you know, each day and it'll feel different every day. Don't expect it to sound the same. Don't expect it to feel the same. And generally I'm happy for them to keep going as long as they know where they're comfortable to sing. The important thing for me is whether they can onset onto their voice cleanly. So if you get any sort of seal noises at the beginning, that's when I think they should definitely stop. But if it sounds easy, if the onset's easy, if their breath's flowing, they're not making any sort of muscular compensations, they're not starting to, you know, to strain with their neck or whatever, then I see no reason why they can't keep going, as long as they don't over try to sing higher than they're capable of. And I think we've managed to help the boys to take responsibility for themselves. That's important for me, that they start to take responsibility for their own singing. They know what they're capable of, that they can track their development, and then it's lovely. I see them. A lot of the boys get a lesson every week. Certainly I'm in every fortnight, and a colleague of mine sees them as well. We work together, so the boys have a lot of singing lessons, so we can track them, and we really know when they should either move down to alto or maybe they can keep going a little bit if their voice separates out and they sing a bit of alto, but then maybe in the main choir or when they're singing hymns, start to gently experiment with their new voices, because I see no reason why they shouldn't start using their new voices. And actually, I think it's really important that they start to use their changed voices, because that informs their falsetto as that comes. And actually, then the falsetto gets better. And, you know, we often track that it all goes very wobbly and then their lower voice settles out. And actually, then they're able to keep going singing some alto for even longer, as long as they don't expect to be sounding the same as they did when they were treble. They have to sort of let that go. And every single boy is completely different. It's trying to just give them that individual attention and make sure that they're all safe and healthy. Safe and healthy is the important thing.
Yeah, that's lovely. I'd like to ask both of you a little bit about what you do, thinking about Malachi, but also any treble really. They get to 12 and 13, they're brilliant at something. I mean, you know, genuinely world class. And then they could wake up the next morning and suddenly that could all be gone. How do you kind of coax them through that sense of uncertainty and that sense that of work that's been done that has been just as swiftly undone? Is there are there any sort of, I don't know, tips that you can offer for that to make sure that they don't become discouraged or become demoralized by the whole process?
For me, as at that time, I suppose it's really to try and reinforce to them that everything that they've done doesn't change when their voice changes. Everything that they've set up, if they're singing well and they've worked on, you know, certainly getting their good alignment and all of the things that trigger their good singing and all of the things, the way that they think, that their voice will show them where it wants to go, and that it's they will be able to carry on with making music once it settles, and to always have that in the back of their mind that none of that changes.
Yeah, the principles are exactly the same, aren't they?
Absolutely,
yes. Yeah, I think seeing it as being a new adventure is the way that I often put it to the boys, you know, that they've got this extraordinary new instrument that's coming. I mean, what I find with the boys here is that it's about the change in their routine as much as the loss of voice as well, because, of course, we rehearse virtually every morning, and so the boys' form class, if you like, is the scholar rather than the form that they're in. And they now have to go back into sort of the downstairs. We're on the top floor here, so they go back down into the sort of, you know, into the reality of the school, as it were. And I think the change can be quite stressful for them. But I generally find most boys, because of the kind of changes, the hormonal changes that come with the voice change, a lot of them aren't necessarily too upset. They kind of accept it as something that's just coming their way. But occasionally you will get a boy who genuinely, you know, really can't imagine what he's going to do without being able to be involved in all the music making the way that he has been. And I guess you just have to, you know, you have to sort of do what you can to sort of comfort them through that, really, and tell them that they'd be a very strange man if their voice never changed. You know, they would be unusual. But so it can be a trauma, yeah. But I think for most boys it isn't. I think most boys take it in their stride, you know. And certainly what I find is a challenge with it is that, as Anita was mentioning then about the voice separating, that it would be much easier if the boys' voices just slipped down gradually, you know, if they lost one note a week or something from the top, but the voice remained much the same. But of course, that isn't the way it works. What tends to happen is you get holes develop in the middle of the voice, which leaves them unable to really contribute to things as they used to. Some boys' voices don't do that. Some boys' voices will slip down gradually, but generally, I think these holes emerge and very difficult to kind of keep them completely happy through that time. But most of them seem to take it in their stride. Yeah.
Yeah. They, like you say, their reality is they don't know any difference, are they? So they, do they? So they sort of they're resilient in that sense, I suppose. Let's have a bit more music, Scott. This next one's yours.
So I thought it might be nice to hear the boys sing. This is Owen Park's Cradle Lullaby, which we recorded on a Christmas CD that we made, Christmassy Music Today, with boys' voices and harp. And I asked on Twitter if anybody could recommend pieces, and Owen said to me that this piece would work, which I think it does very beautifully. It's a very beautiful piece. Yeah, I just thought it would maybe show maybe the kind of sound that I'm trying to get the boys to make, which, if I was going to describe it, is quite a free and open sound. I mean, I think that's what everybody wants when people sing, I'm sure, but expressive, you know. And there's a lovely solo on here from a boy called Oliver, who is now 6'3", I think, and certainly couldn't sing like this anymore, but has got now the most lovely tenor voice. So there's light at the end of the tunnel with the voice change. So this is the Cradle Lullaby by Owen Park.
Thank you.
That was Owen Park's Cradle Lullaby, sung by the Scholar of Cardinal Vaughan Memorial School, with harpist Zita Silver, and the soloist there was Oliver Smith. Now, Anita, can I just come to you and talk a bit about when I've seen you work, and I sang at Westminster Cathedral for a while, and also I've seen you with both Scott's and Charles's choirs. When you warm the boys up, when you work with them, you do loads of physical stuff. Is that? Can you tell us a bit about that? Is it Feldenkrais, or is it a mix of stuff, or?
That is a mix of stuff. I did that way before I trained as a Feldenkrais practitioner, but I do incorporate, of course, my Feldenkrais way of thinking. But I had an amazing singing teacher when I was doing my degree, and she worked very physically, and it just felt like it worked. And so I've always started from gesture and using gesture, because it feels like I can sort of get in through the back door. It becomes a sort of much, so starting with that sort of implicit way of working, so they don't know that they're learning, but you can get them to learn all sorts of skills. And I suppose the more that I've experimented with my Feldenkrais as well, that we mess around with gestures and see what different types of gestures do to the voice. So, you know, we do things like bouncing balls. We might do accents, and we might like do little sharp bounces, and that makes the voice do one thing. Whereas if we do like stroking the cat sort of type of feeling, that makes the voice do something else. For starting sounds, I do quite a lot of either stepping into sound, stepping backwards, feeling like you're sinking into different textures into the floor. So something that's got a bit more spring or something that's hard will affect the voice in different ways. Or if you, I often do pulling things, and if you, you know, pull something with, if you tug it, it will make the onset happen in one way. If you do it gently and have more resistance or less resistance, or move your arm through chocolate or water or just air, the effect is different on the voice. And that's what is lovely for the boys to experience, that so that then they develop choices and they sort of develop some skills that then just automatically, I hope, start to come through in the music and in the way they sing and what's demanded of them in a more formal sort of choral setting. And it also gets them out of the stalls.
Yeah, I'd like to talk about that a bit more, actually. My sense is that what you're trying to do is basically not tell them that you're teaching them. that you're trying to give them a whole range of options, none of which are to do with just technical nuts and bolts. And I don't mean that in a negative way, because singing, I think it's really... it's often misunderstood in all sorts of places. It's not really a technical thing, primarily. It's a communicative, expressive thing, right? And as soon as we access the range of communication that we all have, that can inform all of our singing. Now, you mentioned the stalls. Is there something you're able to do with boys who aren't required to sing so many services a week? You know, the kids at Westminster Cathedral, for example, had eight or nine services a week. Is there a speed of coverage of material that makes that work more difficult to integrate, or is that even more useful?
It is a challenge because they're having to be in their heads so much, which is why I try to get them into their bodies as much as I possibly can. And also, and to give them some ideas, whether they take them on board, the Feldenkrais idea of good posture, and he doesn't like posture as a word, actually. He used a word which was acture, which I really prefer. So the way you act is the ability to move in any direction at any moment of time without any preparation. So by playing with that as an idea, that you can do big movements and we can do lots of weight shifting and feel how the rest of the body responds to that weight shift, and then be able to take it smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller, so that it almost goes into your imagination and it's imperceivable, but you're not, you're never required to stand still. There shouldn't be any requirement to stand still. There's always something moving. And also, I suppose with that thought, I try and feed that in as sort of potential for everything. So whether that's the way that you develop a sound, you never sort of take yourself down a dead end. There's always got to be potential. The way your tongue's moving, the way your jaw's moving, that everything, you, there's not a position for anything. If you try to find a position, then you're restricting yourself. And I think that seems to feed in to that having to work in the stalls. In many ways, sometimes I do find myself just saying, for goodness sake, just stand on both feet, you know, when I see them like lolloping over onto one hip, and I try and find all sorts of different ways of getting them to sense that, and I have to just go, right, when they're ready to take that on board, they'll take it on board. And I have, you know, not get myself frustrated when I know that actually it's going to help more than they realise.
Yeah, I suspect we can all relate to that in some degree. Scott, can I just come to you about sort of the amount of stuff you're able to do with the kids and the speed of preparation? What enables you? I mean, you and I did the Monteverdi Vespers, which is a really hard. There's a lot of notes apart from anything else.
Yeah.
A couple of months ago. How do you get through so much rep with the kids?
Well, I mean, we do rehearse a fair amount, and we don't have, of course, our school mass doesn't involve a great deal of music, so I don't have a kind of liturgical, responsibility the way that a choir of this kind would often have, which does free us up to do a more varied approach, perhaps. You know, we kind of have to have that, really, because there isn't the driving force of the liturgy driving us forward. So I need to constantly be finding things for us to do to keep the whole thing moving forward. But there is, I was thinking the other day, we were learning, we were lucky enough to be asked to go and sing at the Thomaskirche back in February. And we did 3 days singing, replacing the Thomanichor for the motet. And they asked us to sing Jesu meine Freude, which I've never done before. And so we started learning it in January. And of course, it's difficult. And at first, the boys, as in the first time they see it, they find it, they struggle slightly, and it was a bit of a challenge. And then the following day, they come back and they can all sing it. And I don't know exactly what's happened. And it does scare me that I don't fully understand that process. I think sleeping on it is a very important thing, I think, actually, isn't it? That's key to it, really. But it was incredibly striking with bits of the Jesu meine Freude that they were struggling. And then they came back the following day and they seemed to be able to do it. And the answer, I think, really, in terms of the amount of music we do is obviously that it's obviously entirely reliant on reading. And within a boys' choir, I imagine most boys' choirs, there are different levels of reading ability. So some of the boys read as well as I do and are very confident readers. It's quite remarkable, some of them. Others are getting better and better at it all the time. And there are some boys who probably can't read a note, really. But the whole thing works, and they get carried along together. I remember years ago we had a boy who was a wonderful singer, and he wouldn't look at the music. And I remember him sight reading something at the top of his voice, looking out the window. And he was just singing ever so slightly behind what everyone else did, with extraordinary confidence and accuracy, you know. But so there's different ways of doing it, really. But yeah, I mean, obviously the reason we can get through so much music the way we do is because the boys read. And and from day one, there's this emphasis on reading. I find that if you do lots of polyphony with them, that is the best teacher for reading, really, just singing polyphony, because obviously, in a sense, it's simpler in some respects, rhythmically and in terms of intervals and what have you. So I often, I will try as much as I possibly can to have some polyphony in every rehearsal that I do, regardless of what we've got going on.
I could talk about this for hours, couldn't we? Before we hear our last track, can we hear a little bit about how each of you got to where you got to? You know, how all of us, I guess, who end up, you know, doing musical endeavours have had brilliant musical teachers along the way, or brilliant teachers of other subjects, I guess. Anita, how did you end up where you are? What were the formative elements in your life?
Well, I suppose by accident is the answer, really. Actually, I wanted to be a speech therapist was my very first thing. And then I messed my A-levels up and ended up going through clearing and training as a primary school teacher with music specialism. And I moved from my science A-levels, which I flunked, to going back to my music because I had a musical background. I was a junior at Trinity. I played the French horn and I started singing quite a bit later. And that then I started and my singing took over. I did my dissertation on should children be taught how to sing? So at that point, I was really interested in whether it was a good thing to teach children how to do it. And that's when I started to develop all these sort of gestures. And I was just working in class music and used that as my sort of research. And then I went on to Guildhall and I did, well, I did 3 years of postgrad at the Guildhall, the vocal training course, then 2 years on the opera course, and then I went to National Opera Studio. But while I was on the opera course, the job came up at Westminster Cathedral, and one of the coaches there knew I'd worked with children, and I was a singer, and I was recommended, and I just went to James O'Donnell, and he gave me the job. I'd never taught trebles, but I was singing at quite a high level, and I taught primary school age. And that's where I cut my teeth, and he was extraordinary and just let me do whatever I wanted. I mean, I did mad stuff and I pulled the kids around the room and, you know, we did all the gestures and he let me do, I had 20 minutes to warm them up. And I did all of my weird, wacky stuff. And then that sort of led to me, actually I taught at Eton for a while. So I then did teach the trebles and changing voices. And then, you know, I just got known for not specialising, because I still have young professional singers and I teach undergraduates in Cambridge as well. I teach choral scholars at Selwyn. So I teach the whole gamut, and my oldest student is in her 80s, who I've taught for over 20 years. And I love teaching anybody who wants to sing. But that's how I've ended up really teaching trebles. And I just love it so much. And I don't really perform at all anymore. That's just taken over my life. But it has been a bit of an accident.
Yeah, I know that feeling. And do you miss the performing at all? Do you feel that there's a gap there?
Not really. I don't think I was a natural stage animal. That all happened slightly by accident. I loved the song repertoire. I loved the poetry. That's where I came from. Debussy was my thing when I was, you know, that was what I really loved singing. And then everybody auditioned for the opera course at the Guildhall. I'd never stepped foot on stage and I always felt a bit like a fish out of water. I never really enjoyed doing oratorio other than like things like Nelson Mass. I loved, because that was music making and it's all within an ensemble. The standing out and doing an aria and then sitting down for hours, really I hated.
It's a bit weird, isn't it?
I know, and opera-wise, I loved the big ensemble. I sang Alice in Falstaff, and I loved that because it was all, and Cosie and Marriage of Figaro a bit less, because again, you're there, you've got your big arias. Cosie I loved, you know, because when there's all that group music making ensemble and working with other people and refining it and listening to diphthongs and really... that was the singing that I loved. So actually, I don't really miss it at all.
That's a good answer. It's interesting to hear that. We could talk for hours about about why we sing in ensembles or why we sing solos and that kind of stuff as well. There's lots of things to think about. Scott, tell us about you retain, I think, your lyrical Welsh lilt.
Yeah, yes, indeed. I'm Welsh. I feel a little bit of a fraud, actually, in a sense, on this podcast, because I don't really have a background in choral singing. I guess I sang as a child, and I had quite a good treble voice, as I recall, but I wasn't a chorister and didn't enjoy any of those benefits, unfortunately. And what I know, very little I know about choral singing and training boys, has been learned from Anita, mostly, I would say, My teacher is with us today, and it's been learned by doing it with the kids here, you know, the over the last however long it's been now, and so I don't really have that that particular background. I was a trombonist, which I don't think if that's ideal training for choral training. I don't know, really, probably not. But that was my musical background. But the way I've always approached it really is that music is music. I did do a lot of music. I did a lot of orchestral music, a lot of orchestral conducting, and it strikes me that essentially it's music making, and that's kind of been what I've been. That's kind of what I've grounded myself with. Whilst at the same time, you know, going to watch people like James O'Donnell and Anita mentioned, you know, seeing the way that he worked with the boys, being terribly open to trying to learn about ways in which I can get better at this, and I still feel that way. I was thinking that, you know, one of the many joys of doing the work that we do, for me anyway, is that when I walk in the rehearsal in the morning, every day is like a new start. Every day feels like every day I'm going to try something slightly different. Every day I'm going to just have a slightly different take on things. And so I'm very keen to try and, you know, learn. And I think remaining open to learning, and also, as I said, being lucky enough to work with Anita, who is extraordinary in the work she does with the boys. And I'm sure anybody who's, you know, all the people who've been lucky enough to have their choirs trained by her would agree with that. That's been a massive privilege as well. And I feel incredibly fortunate, really, to have had that opportunity.
Thanks for that. This is a huge topic, and we're really only dealing with a small part of it, the three of us today. I think on the podcast we'll talk further about female voices and how they might change and what that kind of how that impacts the singing voice. Before we hear the last track, which I think is something a little bit special, any advice that the two of you would give to your, let's say, yourselves 20, 30 years ago? Without really revealing too many ages?
For me, it's go with the flow. Don't plan too much. Take advantage of every moment you have, because everything, every moment is a learning opportunity. And knockbacks can be a learning opportunity. I wasn't very good at dealing with those knockbacks. But they've made me, I think, stronger, even if they've made me make a different decision and go in a different direction. But I'm a great believer in fate, and because it has been such a random journey for me, and I'm very happy with where I am. I'm actually very glad I'm not in a hospital as a speech therapist. I'm having a lot more fun, so I think maybe not. But I'm very happy with where life's taken me by just going with it.
So I think if I was looking back at those years, one thing I would want to say to myself is to realise that that it's not a rehearsal, as it were. When you're doing these things, it's not there isn't some golden performance around the corner that's going to be 1,000 times better. That you need to enjoy things for what they are. And one thing I've come to take greater pride in is enjoying the sound, since we're talking about the choir, just enjoying the sound that the boys make. And if I was to be hoping it's going to sound like Westminster Cathedral Choir and not happy with it until it does, then I think you'd never be happy, because clearly it's never going to sound like that. That shouldn't be the ambition. And to take pride, whilst of course being as ambitious for it as possible, and trying to achieve as high a level as we can, but taking pride in it for what it is, I think is something that it's taken me a little while to learn, but I'm getting better and better at, and just enjoying it really, and enjoying the process, and enjoying the extraordinary privilege really of being able to work with these young people and to give them these opportunities and to see them grow and love it so much. You know, I think it's a real gift, and I'm very lucky to be doing this.
That's lovely. Look, I think, as I say, we could talk all day, but I think we should leave the listeners with the final track, which is, I think, your choice, Anita. Do you want to tell us a bit about it?
Yes. So I've been working with the boys at St. George's Windsor for quite a while now. And James Vivian is wonderful to work with. We work very collaboratively. So I only go in once every couple of weeks. So I share the teaching with Ben Alden, who's one of the tenors in the choir, and he does a lot of work with the boys. But when I go in, I usually have 20 minutes, half an hour with the boys, and we work, and James and I work collaboratively. So I'll do a little bit of a warm-up, and then he'll take bits and pieces out of what they've been working on during the week, and we sort of troubleshoot, but it's, you know, I work physically with them, and we try and find imagination things, all sorts of stuff. And this track was the choristers sang at the Queen's funeral, of course, for the committal, and we worked very hard. We were very lucky because they get through so much music. We get to a really good level and they're singing beautifully, but we had the opportunity to work in a huge amount of detail on the Harris Bring Us O Lord God. And I was so proud of those boys. The colour that they found, we managed to get them really using their imagination. And I do think it was, and with all of that pressure and the nerves on the day, they'd really embodied, they had time to really embody everything about it. So none of those nerves came across. And I just thought it was astonishing singing and absolutely beautiful. And I'm just very, very proud of what they achieved for that.
Yeah, I think I remember hearing that and thinking, actually, this is, you know, such a big occasion. This distills so much of what we're all trying to do all the time about poetry and meaning and embodiment and music. Obviously, this amazing poem, and the way that music elevates things like any occasion, really. I think it was, yeah, it's very special piece, but a particularly special performance. Let's hear it.
Thank you.
So that was William H. Harris's Bring Us, O Lord God, from the committal of the Queen's body last year with the Choir of St. George's Chapel, Windsor, conducted by James Vivian. That's all we have time for really today. Thank you both so much for coming on. It's been so instructive and enlightening, illuminating to talk to you. As I say, we'll have you on again because there's so much more to talk about. But it's great to start this conversation, such a big topic, and great to hear such wisdom and humanity on the subject. Thanks both so much.
Thank you.
Complete pleasure.
Bye for now.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Just before you go, another reminder to try listening on Patreon, which costs just a few pounds per month. Or if you prefer, you can very simply make a one-off donation. You can actually do either via choralchihuahua.com. Thanks.